Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After signing into law a provision that permits healthcare clinicians to refuse services that violate their religious or moral beliefs, Governor DeWine predicted little would change.
Let's say the doctor is against abortions. The doctor is not doing abortions. If there's other things that maybe a doctor has a conscience problem with, it gets worked out. Somebody else does those things. So, this is not a problem.
The city of Columbus disagrees and is suing the state over the law, which was tucked into the state operating budget without debate last summer. The ACLU also is suing the state about how the law was passed without public input. Ohio is one of a number of Republican-led states taking steps to offer greater protections to clinicians opposed to everything from abortions to blood transfusions to vaccines. Anna Staver of the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau has been covering this story. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So State Senator Terry Johnson, that's a Republican from McDermott, an osteopathic physician, introduced the amendment last year at the last minute, an amendment to the state budget bill last minute without any public hearings. What was his rationale for doing that then there?
Well, the state budget is actually sometimes a catch-all for a lot of different pieces of legislation. Keep in mind, it's at least 2,000 to 3,000 pages. Like, mm-hmm. We're talking several fantasy novels long.
So he wanted to slip it in.
Yeah,
quietly.
And that's not uncommon. I mean, there is a question about whether it's appropriate, but it is absolutely something that happens.
And he wanted to do that because he didn't want debate, or he just thought of it and thought, ooh, quick, let's put it in the budget bill, or what?
I don't know what was in his heart or mind when he decided
And he doesn't say?
No, he doesn't. And I think it is an issue that has come up before in Ohio, and that is the sort of the heart of the ACLU lawsuit, is do this as a separate standing bill.
Mm-hmm. Governor DeWine said he didn't veto the provision. He could have do a line item veto because it was a budget bill, because he said he didn't do it because no one would be discriminated against because of it. Has the law been put to the test as far as you know yet?
I don't know if there's an individual who's brought claim of discrimination as of yet, but that is the real concern, because it just says that, we should be clear that there are federal protections. There are conscience clauses if you mm-hmm. go to the Health and Human Services website of the federal government.
So it's already there. Yeah.
Yes, but those are more specific. Those deal with things like abortion, or what they call sterilization, so vasectomies and getting your tubes tied. It also deals with euthanasia in states where that's legal. And so the question in Ohio is, there is no such spelling out in that terminology. So the question becomes legally what falls under that umbrella. So would a trans man be denied testosterone because his pharmacist does not believe in it? Would an unmarried woman be denied birth control because someone does not believe in premarital sex? Like, how far Ohio's law could be interpreted is the concern.
LGBTQ rights advocates worry that the conscience clause will strengthen barriers to treatment and mental health care for them. More than 250 anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced in state legislatures, including in Ohio. What reassurance have lawmakers in the medical community given to them?
I think you hear what Governor DeWine said, is that if someone doesn't want to perform a procedure, or a therapist doesn't want to provide care, that, quote, somebody else will do it. And that gets really challenging, because I think, when someone denies you care, I'm sure it's humiliating and embarrassing and uncomfortable. But also, it's hard to find a mental health provider. It's hard to find a general care practitioner, one that takes your insurance, one that has availability and won't make you wait 4 months for an eye appointment.
In this, the best healthcare system in the whole world? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I know. I just recently, I ran out of contacts, and I called my eye doctor, and he was like, it's going to be 6 weeks. And I'm like, okie dokie.
There go the glasses today, right?
Yeah. And they're like, it's not the easiest thing in the world to make these appointments mm-hmm. in the first place. So when doctor after doctor turns you down, I imagine it is quite disheartening.
A number of medical organizations opposed the law at the time and still do, including the Ohio Hospital Association, the Ohio State Medical Association, which is mostly doctors, and the Ohio Association of Health Plans. What was the basis of their opposition?
Well, I think it comes down to, there are strong federal protections that have been around. Like, even the Affordable Care Act, which we call Obamacare, had codified protections against providing abortion if you have moral objections. So the idea is there's very spelled out exemptions in law already, and the vagueness of the state law is where they think it could be potentially problematic, because I think, you know, as somebody who's covered state legislatures for years now, I'm sure you know, too, that when a law is vague, it's the words on the page that the judge interprets, that the jury interprets. And if you could make a reasonable and honest conviction that, say, my morals don't allow me to provide birth control, then that fits.
Have any other cities sued the state over this issue or entities at all?
No. So it's Zach Klein in the city of Columbus and then Equitas and ACLU. But and it's important to know they're suing on two very different tracks. It's not the same
substance of the provision. The other one's how it was included in the state budget bill.
Yes. The super nerdy single subject rule.
And what is Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost said?
He hasn't made too much public comment as of yet, but I imagine that he intends to defend the law in, you know, sort of the argument that Governor DeWine gave, that this is something that already exists, that's already happening. You know, if a doctor doesn't want to perform an abortion, they find someone else. Like, I'm sure, you know, as many women who have gone to an OB, they might say, like, look, this is just things I don't provide. And you're like, okay.
But that's another question is, are patients protected? Do they have foreknowledge of what their doctor does and doesn't cover, or their clinician or their or whoever it might be? I mean, are they protected in this?
I don't, you know, I can only speak to my personal experience, but I don't know that I've ever asked those questions of a medical professional. And I think it might be the onus might be on the patient to sort of ask whether that is a service that they provide or they feel comfortable providing. You know, when I go to my gynecologist, I don't think it's ever come up, so I don't really know where she stands on it.
Joining us now is City of Columbus Solicitor General Rich Coglanese. He is representing the city in its lawsuit against the state. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
So far, there's been no refusal of treatment that you're aware of, so why file the suit now?
So, you know, Columbus is a very diverse city with a lot of different types of people, types of families. We don't want to be in a position where, you know, somebody goes into a medical provider and is told, I'm sorry, you can't get a vaccine. You know, the city of Columbus has a vaccine clinic. The State House News Bureau was very active covering the debates on COVID vaccines. I don't want to have a nurse over there be able to say this vaccine is going to make you magnetic, so I'm not giving it to you. And by the way, as a medical provider, there is nothing the city of Columbus can do to move that person out of that position. We would violate the law there.
Right, because it protects the clinician from retribution by the employer.
Correct.
Right.
And the other part of this is, and you haven't really covered it yet, is the insurance aspect of it. This allows an insurance company to deny payment, any healthcare payer to deny payment for anything that they believe violates their conscience. So we could be in a situation, for example, Anne, that you have somebody who believes in eugenics, and that person can deny prenatal care, prenatal coverage, or refuse to pay for the birth of a child under this bill.
This is what violates the Federal Affordable Care Act.
Yes. And interestingly enough, it also violates the grants that we get from the Ohio Department of Health, because we have to certify to the Ohio Department of Health through the Ryan White funds, through the vaccine funds, that we are not discriminating. But we can be in a position that somebody can discriminate. So we're really in an impossible position here.
What about what Governor DeWine says? Well, if one doctor won't do it, then another doctor will.
Part of that is the problem that people have to go through. These are patients seeking medical care. They should not have to worry about that. As it relates to the, you know, Columbus Department of Public Health, a lot of these folks that use those services may be low-income individuals who have had to take a day off of work, possibly without pay, maybe turned away. And, you know, if it's a situation where there is only one employee in that area who is opposed to that treatment, we may have problems getting them services at all. So we don't want to wait for that.
You know, Anna Staver, one thing I wanted to bring, has anyone raised to the governor or anybody the issue of rural health care and how maybe there's only one doctor in the room, in the whole building?
No, that's a really excellent point, because rural health care is complicated. I actually did a story in Colorado about a county that had no primary care physician. And like, think about like the 2-3 hours that like pregnant women were driving to get like prenatal care. And it is different because, you know, we live in Columbus, you and I, and if one doctor won't take me, another doctor will. And when you get out into Appalachia towards the West Virginia border, there may be one doctor within an hour of you.
Rich Coglanis, City Attorney Zach Klein also said that the conscience clause in the Ohio budget that was passed through the Ohio budget violates home rule. How so?
What it is doing is telling us how to structure our employees. So it tells us that we can't transfer the nurse that is opposed to vaccines out of the vaccine clinic. It also tells us that there is a non-retribution clause against health insurance companies. So if our health insurance company decides not to pay for certain procedures, we can't actually go out and switch health coverages. We've got, as a city, the right to make those decisions. We enter into collective bargaining agreements with our unions over healthcare coverage. Our city council passes statutes over that. And the state is telling us it doesn't matter what those contracts say. If the company says no, you've got to keep that company.
Let me make sure I understand. From what I understand, the city must maintain insurance coverage from a company that could reject or refuse.
Yes. Yes. And if, because there's
you,
those.
You just, mean, why? I mean, I don't get.
That's the way this bill is written. It's part of the last minute problems that the ACLU was focusing on, that by saying a healthcare payer can't be discriminated against, you can't do anything to the healthcare payor either. So if, you know, if it turns into a situation where our health companies decide not to provide coverage for certain things, we cannot as a city make a determination to go elsewhere. And that also, again, violates the guarantees of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, you can't discriminate against an insurance company. I got it. And yep. What are you hearing from insurance companies?
So far, nothing. And we are hoping that that's the case, but all it takes is, you know, one situation. And in fact, this bill is written so poorly that it is conceivable that it could simply be a claims adjuster at an insurance company saying, I don't want to sign my name approving this bill.
And the insurance company couldn't fire them for following their conscience. Interesting. I thought it just applied to clinicians.
No, it also applies to, it also specifically okay, applies just, to healthcare
all right,
payers.
I just wanted to make sure. And then further, in terms of whether or not it violates the Federal Affordable Care Act, would that have to be something settled in a federal court?
No. So we did actually raise those claims that there is a federal laws that are contrary to this, and under the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, this law can't stand. And the Franklin County Common Pleas Court can actually hear that case.
Okay. Well, Rich Coglanis, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ann.
Yeah, that's City of Columbus Solicitor General Rich Coglanis. He's representing the city in its lawsuit against the state over the conscience clause that permits clinicians, and that includes healthcare insurance providers, the right to refuse service or to pay for services that they find conflicts with their personal, religious, or moral beliefs. We're going to dig down into this more. Anna Staver, I need to say thanks to you as well. I really appreciate you coming in today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Anna Staver. She's State House reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. She's been covering this at the State House. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Congress in 1973 passed the first so-called Conscience Clause law, also known as the Church Amendment, in response to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade. At the time, Democratic Senator Frank Church of Idaho said the clause was needed to enable religious hospitals to opt out of performing operations contrary to their beliefs. The Conscience Clause issue has been revived in states recently, including in Ohio. The city of Columbus and the ACLU recently sued the state over the law, which was tucked into the state operating budget last summer. Mark Wickler is a professor of philosophy emeritus at West Virginia University. He's an adjunct professor of medicine and part-time instructor of bioethics at the Center for Bioethics and Health Law at the University of Pittsburgh. His 2011 book is titled Conscientious Objection in Healthcare, An Ethical Analysis. Welcome to the show, Mark Wickler.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks for inviting me.
The issue of conscientious objection in medicine, it isn't new. Was 1973 sort of the first time it reared its head, or had it been discussed before?
Well, prior to the 1960s, conscientious objection in medicine and healthcare generally was really, really virtually unheard of. For, you know, many, many years, historically, conscientious objection was primarily in the context of military service. And it was only in the 1970s, that there was significant attention paid to conscientious objection. And that was primarily in relation to abortion and sterilization. And you mentioned the Roe versus Wade decision, 1973, but there was a prior decision in a Billings, Montana federal court that also accounted for the Church Amendment. And that decision involved a physician who was practicing in a Catholic hospital, and the hospital had refused him the permission to perform a tubal ligation for a patient. And the physician filed suit in federal court in Billings. And the court issued a preliminary injunction against the hospital that required it to allow the physician to perform the tubal ligation. And the reasoning of the federal court at that time was that even though it was a private hospital, Catholic hospital, it received federal funding. And because it received federal funding, it could be required to satisfy federal guidelines. So, the next year, with the Roe versus Wade decision, which found that abortion is a constitutionally guaranteed right, that's what really stimulated the Church Amendment, because they were thinking of, the Congress was thinking of what had happened in Billings. And so they tried to, what the purpose was, is to block courts from ordering institutions or individual providers to provide specifically, this was limited now, specifically at that time, to either abortion or tubal ligation.
In the Billings case, in that case of the physician wanting to perform a tubal ligation, I don't know if it was he or she, but the physician wanted to do so after a C-section, right?
That's correct.
And the argument was that, well, if she has to go somewhere else, that means she has to go through a whole nother operation to get the tubal ligation, which is a form of birth control, by the way, for people who don't know. And that would expose her to more risk.
Correct.
What about her? I mean, how does that play out as far as the patient's rights go?
Well, as both of your previous guests have indicated, generally, these conscience clauses, whether it's federal government or state government, state laws, they really offer little, if any, protection for patients. The Ohio bill is a perfect paradigm example of that, where there's absolutely no mention of the effect, the impact it can have on patients. And hospitals are prohibited from doing anything to physicians to try to assure that patients will get access to services. They can't penalize them. So that is really a major problem with these laws, is no protection at all of patients. It protects providers, but it doesn't protect patients.
And it doesn't protect the provider's employers, right? The patient could sue the hospital, but not the physician, him or herself.
Well, I'm not sure about who they could sue.
Okay.
The problem is that the laws would, again, this varies, but in some states, both institutions and providers are immunized from lawsuits.
Okay.
So the protection goes a few ways. So the hospitals may not punish in any way or discipline in any way providers who jeopardize the health of patients. And that really then prohibits institutions from doing anything in terms of their staffing to ensure the health of patients. In relation specifically now to conscientious objection.
Can they ask when a physician, I don't know how it works, how physicians get their jobs, but when they apply for a job at a hospital, can the hospital ask them, is there anything you wouldn't do for a patient because of moral or religious views?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I'm not a legal scholar, but I think there is a problem there, where a hospital might very well want to make sure that it has staffing that provides services. Like it's an intensive care unit, they want physicians and nurses who will provide the services that are traditionally provided in an ICU. But I think at least one danger with these laws, and again, I'm not a legal scholar, but yeah, I think it does tend to prohibit institutions, employers, from doing just this kind of investigation that you're talking about, which seems to be a reasonable thing for employers to do. I mean, to use a very maybe extreme example, suppose you have a Planned Parenthood clinic and a person applies who's opposed to family planning. Well, as I think sort of a plausible interpretation of these conscience protection laws is the Planned Parenthood clinic couldn't say to this potential employee, I'm sorry, what we do here is Planned Parenthood. And if you can't do this because of your moral or religious beliefs, we can't hire you. I think that would be, again, an issue that might raise problems for the Planned Parenthood clinic, that the prospective employee might bring suit under the conscience protection laws.
I'm thinking about ads I've seen, like job openings, and they say something like, must be able to lift at least 20 pounds to do this job. Would this would be different than that then. Not, you couldn't say must be able to feel comfortable discussing and implementing family planning procedures.
Right. I mean, the only way that it would protect somebody who couldn't lift over 20 pounds would be if they had a moral or religious objection to it. Right. Okay. My religion says I can't lift more than 20 pounds.
And then therefore you must hire me anyways. You can't use that as a reason not to hire me.
Right.
Hypothetically, it's wild, but it's still, I'm trying to get the logic of it.
Right. I think there is no logic.
You know, presidents from George W. Bush to Donald Trump have shaped federal regulations that govern conscientious objection by medical professionals. How have they weighed in and shaped the law? I mean, since 1973.
Well, it's been, at least on a federal level, there are, now in addition to the Church Amendment, there's been some legislation passed which expands the Church Amendment, and then there have been separate amendments, the Weldon Amendment and the Coates Amendment. They affect payers as well as graduate medical education, residency programs. Specifically, they can't require the training of residents for abortions. So there have been a number of additional laws passed by Congress, but one thing that has been sort of a roller coaster in terms of presidents are the federal regulations. At the tail end of the George W. Bush administration, there was a very lengthy regulation that was offered by the Department of Health and Human Services, which is sort of expanded version of the Ohio law in the sense that it offered extremely broad protections. In addition, it included within the type of people who were covered by this, just like the Ohio law does, they could be any person somehow connected to delivery of healthcare. It's not restricted to physicians or nurses. It could be a filing clerk.
Okay.
That's an objection. It could be somebody who cleans or sterilizes the surgical equipment for abortions. It was very broad in the sense of the kinds of procedures and the kinds of involvement. So it's not just direct involvement. Surgeons or OBGYNs are protected if they can't, for religious or moral reasons, perform abortions. It doesn't just protect them, it protects people who assist them, and a very broad interpretation of assisting. Now, that was introduced, as I said, at the tail end of the George W. Bush administration. Obama was elected, and then in his administration, they basically shelved those regulations.
Uh-huh.
Fast forward to the Trump administration, they reintroduced those regs and made them even more stringent, a broader protection. And again, the major, I think, concern is the impact that this would have on patients was not considered at all. I should mention, by the way, it's not just the impact on patients. It's also the impact that these conscientious refusals can have on other healthcare professionals in the same facility. Somebody, as Governor DeWine says, somebody else will do it well, but that means that other people have to do more work. And that can be extremely burdensome, and it can impose burdens on institutions as well.
You know, I got a ton of questions, and I'm thinking, okay, are there any examples of harm out there from this?
Well, I mean, yes, women have died.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know, yeah.
Yes, women have died because of objections to performing procedures that were, when they were pregnant, that were needed to prevent them from dying. So, I mean, that's a pretty drastic thing, but I think some of your other guests pointed out various burdens,
yeah,
and delays in treatments because you're looking for somebody can be very, very, very harmful to people in terms of their health.
Is there any fair warning required? In other words, say a woman is in a physician's office, she's found to have an ectopic pregnancy, it's going to kill her, and there needs to be an abortion done, or however they, you know, end that kind of a pregnancy. I'm not sure how it works, but that's when the fertilized egg starts to grow in the fallopian tube instead of the uterus. So it's going to kill her. So, like, all of a sudden you're in the room, you're in the operating room, and a physician's assistant, somebody there assisting the surgeon or whoever it might be, says, oh, wait a minute, I don't believe in doing this. This violates my personal beliefs, and walks out of the room or whatever. What about that? So is there any obligation to say, by the way, if this ever happens, I won't be able to help?
Well, I'm an ethicist, so I would say yes, there is an ethical obligation.
Okay.
In terms of the law, I'm afraid there is, as far as I know, no legal obligation to do that.
Okay.
And again, that's another one of the, I think, shortcomings of these conscience clauses in that they do not offer sufficient protections for patients.
Let's see, we got Joanne in Columbus. Joanne, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention that I just heard about or read a report, a nonprofit academic report from the Merger Watch Project that's tracking the growth of Catholic hospital systems mm-hmm. and talks specifically about the ethical and religious directives, the EDRs. Mm-hmm. And one of the very interesting and I think hidden components that we all need to be aware of is that what we're finding now is that Catholic hospitals, both in acute care and full hospitals, are merging with nonprofits. But in those merger contracts, they are requiring that their ethical and religious directives of the Catholic hospitals
yeah.
are now embodied in these nonprofit hospitals.
Which from the outsider looks like a secular, regular,
exactly.
non-religious hospital. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
And it was this report was just fascinating and eye-opening, and I, you know, then looked up my gynecologist who's at Mount Carmel, but I'm beyond, you know, children-bearing years, but now it's part of Trinity Health, and also just what about a DNR, and so on and so
and
forth.
What'd they say?
And I haven't done my conversation with
okay.
yet, but I just, that's actually next week,
yeah.
but I just think that this notion of the ethical and religious directives that are now embedded in secular facilities, both acute care, if you go yeah. to a rehab center, and so I just think that we are not even aware of the depth of both the financial and the ethical implications of our new healthcare reality.
Hmm. Joanne, thank you for that. Mark Wickler, she's right. I was going to ask you that
absolutely.
Question myself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what this shows, again, in response to Governor DeWine's response, they can go, you know, find somebody else. This merger of hospitals makes it much, much more difficult, even in big cities, to find providers, at least in a timely fashion.
Joanne, thanks so much for that call. I appreciate it. Everybody else out there, you can give us a call if you have a question, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mark Wickler, professor of philosophy emeritus at West Virginia University. He's also an adjunct professor of medicine and part-time instructor of bioethics at the Center for Bioethics and Health Law at the University of Pittsburgh. And his 2011 book is titled Conscientious Objection in Healthcare and Ethical Analysis. He's going to stay with us. And coming up, we're going to have a senior research fellow from the Heritage Foundation, which supports these conscience clauses, to join us and give us their take. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about medical conscience clauses, which protect healthcare clinicians from doctors to nurses to pharmacists to kind of anybody who's in the medical field to opt out of performing or providing medical services that conflict with their moral or religious beliefs. The city of Columbus and the ACLU of Ohio recently sued the state over a conscience clause tucked into the state operating budget last summer without debate. Still with us, Mark Wickler. He is professor of philosophy emeritus at West Virginia University. He's also an adjunct professor of medicine and a part-time instructor of bioethics at the Center for Bioethics and Health Law at the University of Pittsburgh. His 2011 book is titled Conscientious Objection in Healthcare and Ethical Analysis. Ed Hasselmeyer is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative think tank which supports efforts in the states to protect conscience rights. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, just to pick up from what we were talking about a little earlier, I'm wondering about a medical professional Ed Haselmeyer, who feels like they have a moral obligation to perform a needed surgery, such as an abortion, for example, or to end a tubal ligate, end a ectopic pregnancy. So if they're in a religious hospital and they find themselves in that situation, do their moral and does that in that moment, does their moral imperative have protection, even though they're in a hospital that has other directives?
So we can talk about this in general concepts, or we can talk about specific laws. So when you get into specific laws, I'm not, you know, that you would have to look at that in each circumstance. The basic concept, though, is that you respect the conscience rights of individuals in this and other areas. And again, this is also a question, it gets mixed up with some other questions. So for example, is it federal or is it state? So right now you all are talking about a particular Ohio state law, and there may be some issues
with
that.
We're talking about the general concept.
Yeah, the general concept is that, yes, you should respect others' conscience. Now, if it's an organization that you are joining that has certain principles, then clearly you would follow the principles of the organization or you wouldn't join it.
Okay, well, yes, but what if you join it anyways? So we were talking earlier about hospitals. Yeah. How do hospitals, say it's a secular hospital, they don't want to have a physician on staff that won't do certain things because of religious or moral conscience issues. They can't ask a prospective physician if they have those kinds of objections. So how do you know?
Well, and see, this is the other problem, this is the other issue that gets in here, is because it's closely related to the question of medical views as well. In other words, the independence of the physician in terms of the physician's views. So you could take something that maybe doesn't raise a moral question, like a patient wants, say, bariatric surgery for weight loss. And a physician could say, well, in my medical judgment, that's not appropriate. And so it's a similar sort of situation, though the reason that the physician may be saying that that's not appropriate is more medical than, say, moral. But the question is still the same in that case, which is, does the physician get overruled? Is the physician simply working for somebody else who makes a decision, or does the physician have his or her own autonomy, both as a person in the case of morals and as a professional in the case of medical judgment? And so we're going to see more of that, I think.
But in the case of a medical judgment, that can be critiqued and that can be judged a bad medical judgment and negligent or something like that, and the patient has recourse.
In some cases it can.
Maybe not in the one you
Well, and that's why I selected that one, because that's a particular surgery that on medical grounds is somewhat, you know, uncertain as to, and I'm sure one could come up with other examples as well. And I raise this because we're now entering into a phase when we go, for example, this has usually been around issues like you raised of the moral objection to participating or providing an abortion. But we're now getting into issues regarding gender dysphoria treatment and you know, what's the appropriate care. And this is where these two things meet, because a physician might have moral objections or ethical objections, but another physician might have the same objections on different grounds of medicine. And so you're going to see in this area, I think, a combination of both of those. And what's concerning to us is the idea that you have the government coming in and saying, well, there's only one way. So for example, when the government says, well, you can't discriminate in providing, you know, this kind of care, well, is that with regards to somebody who wants to transition, or is that with regard also with regards to somebody who wants to detransition? Is a physician who says, well, physical intervention is not an appropriate treatment, but psychological counseling is that physician somehow going to be overruled by an established view? So these issues get balled up together.
Yeah, Mark Wickler, do you see a parallel construction here when it comes to medical opinion versus conscience or moral or religious point of view?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think this raises an issue that's, I think, very important, which is there's a asymmetry in the protection that's provided for people who have moral or religious beliefs about medical procedures. As Ed mentioned, one of the kind of areas where there's now quite a bit of, commitment, moral commitment to doing things is providing gender-affirming care for adolescents. And there, Ed mentioned that the government shouldn't say that there's only one way to do things. But I'm afraid in this instance, that's exactly what states are doing. They're passing laws that prohibit physicians from exercising what they think is sound clinical judgment in relation to treating people who do have gender dysphoria.
That's a good point.
They're making it a crime. And what's, I think, most interesting and concerning is there's absolutely no provision for conscientious objection. So it's a one-way street. If you object to procedures that the government thinks maybe are questionable, then we will honor your conscience. If you object to government rules that prohibit you from doing things that in your conscience you think you need to provide for the health of your patients, the government can force you to do that and gives you absolutely no discretion to exercise your conscience.
Yeah, Ed?
I would respond by saying that that introduces yet another dimension to this, because the distinction there is the informed consent distinction and the age of majority. So that's a whole nother place. And essentially the law, the override that you're referring to in the law that you know, blocks the physician from doing something is a general override that relates to whether or not a minor is able to give informed consent on its own. And this applies to all sorts of things. I mean, research protocols and studies and everything else.
I don't think that it's.
So I'm saying that's another dimension as opposed to, say, an adult.
But I think that's a red herring, because in the case of children, it's not the children themselves that are giving consent, it's the parents. And that's sort of the common practice in pediatric medicine is for parents to be the informed decision maker.
I'm going to go to a caller right now who has a really good pragmatic question. Matt in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering, when I go to a new doctor, can I ask which procedures they're going to deny me based on their conscience rights, and do they have to tell me?
What do we know about that? Ed Haselmeyer, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you could.
You can ask, but should they have to tell you?
Well, I don't see any need to compel that. I mean, people would probably, you know.
Why not? If I want to know what my doctor will and won't provide, why shouldn't I be able to find that out?
I mean, this is kind of like, you know. Well, I guess if you go to certain doctors, you're probably going to know that right off the bat up front. I mean, it's kind of like going into a kosher delicatessen. You know that there's certain things that aren't going to be on the menu.
I don't know if that is the case, though, Mark Wickler. I don't know if I've ever asked a doctor, but if I did, I guess I'd kind of want to know.
Right. And I mean, again, I'm an ethicist, so I would focus here on the ethical perspective rather than the legal perspective. Mm-hmm. And I would say there is an obligation if a patient asks, do you provide this or this service, that the physician has an obligation to provide that information. And I think we can't assume that patients are aware of what various clinicians, which services they will or will not provide. So I think, at least from an ethical perspective, I think the answer is pretty clear. I'm reluctant to have really any kind of legal interference with this, because I think that these issues are so complex and complicated that it's very difficult to craft laws that are going to deal with specific situations and give exactly the right weighting to patient interests versus clinician interests.
Yeah, Ed Hasselmeyer?
Yeah, I think that default setting is to also be restrained in legislating as well. And again, this is where I mentioned it comes out to the specifics of particular legislation, how restrained or how unrestrained is the legislation. But yes, you want to have something that does not impinge on the doctor-patient relationship as a rule.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary. Okay, Mary is not there. We will, we're just about out of time anyways. What about patient protection and all of this, Ed Hasselmeyer? What expectations should patients have for the physician or whoever the healthcare professional is to make a choice that's safe for them versus in line with their moral or religious beliefs?
Well, actually, the case where that would come up is really end of life care. And that's where we have things like advanced directives. And you know, this is an interesting question in that area, where the question is, does the patient desire override? So in other words, are they going to respect your end of life directives? And is the institution consistent with your values? I mean, interestingly enough, I participated in a focus group just because I do healthcare policy. And it turns out a lot of it was around Catholic hospitals. And one of the things that came up in that discussion was, you know, they may not be very different from other hospitals, but if you were, you know, at the end of life, I'd rather be in a, some of us would rather be in a Catholic hospital because we understood that they would respect our views on not prematurely ending life by active measures, and things like, you know, euthanasia or assisted suicide. So,
well, that's illegal anyways, almost everywhere in the United States. It's already illegal.
Well, I mean, you see, now this is another area where you have states legalizing these, procedures and treatments. And so, these directives are going to become particularly important in that area. So it's not just on questions like abortion or, gender dysphoria, but it's things like end of life care. You know, the big debate is, or not debate, but the big distinction, and this goes back to some of the things like the Terry Schiavo case, is there's a difference between extraordinary measures, which most everybody would say are morally licit to withdraw. In other words, if you can only breathe with a ventilator, take that off, versus actively, in effect, starving somebody by not giving them food and water until they die. These are the lines that are drawn. And these have been issues that have been around for a while in medical ethics, and are now coming to the fore as more states and more countries are legalizing so-called assisted suicide.
Mark Wickler, we only have about 20 seconds. I just want to give you a chance to respond before we have to say goodbye.
Yeah, well, advanced directives, most legislation on advanced directives in the states do provide for conscientious objection, which is, again, another problem in that one cannot be guaranteed that one's wishes will be implemented. And I'll just very briefly, in Pennsylvania, okay.
We will surely be talking about this again. For now, Mark Wickler, his 2011 book is titled Conscientious Objection in Healthcare and Ethical Analysis. Thanks for your time. And Ed Hasselmeyer, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank, supports efforts to protect conscience rights. This is it. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.